Christopher Deedy, a federal officer, shot and killed Colin Eldredge in November of 2011 and has gone on trial for it twice, with juries unable to convict on charges ranging from second-degree murder to reckless manslaughter to assault in the first degree. The Supreme Court ruled last week that Deedy can go on trial yet again, despite two hung juries, and the Honolulu prosecutor has vowed to pursue the case. But has the prosecution's case already been tainted in two past trials? And what are the distinctions among the charges, manslaughter, murder, or assault? Ronette Kawakami is a lecturer in law at UH Manoa's Richardson Law School, served as a deputy public defender for 26 years. We're asking her to help us sort it all out. Good morning, Ronnie.
Good morning, Chris.
And when I say sort it all out, it really does take some sorting, doesn't it?
Yes, it's a very complicated case. It's not something that's really easy to look at. Even the Supreme Court case that came down last week is a substantial decision. It's a whole bunch of pages. I believe it's around 61 or 67 pages of the actual decision, and then another 30-some-odd pages for the dissent in this case. So mm-hmm. it is there's a whole bunch of issues that were addressed, and Supreme Court, I think, did very well.
Well, a lay opinion might be reading about this. Isn't this double jeopardy, even beyond double jeopardy? He has had two trials, right?
Right. So he has two trials. And double jeopardy basically is a second prosecution for the same offense after there has been an acquittal, mm-hmm. or a second prosecution for the same offense after there's been a conviction, or multiple punishments for the same offense. Mm-hmm. In the Deedy case, you have neither an acquittal nor a conviction. So, and he's not being punished. There's no sentence handed down. So double jeopardy just doesn't apply in this case.
So the idea being that, let's sort of set the stage. The first case sought a murder conviction, did not offer the option of a manslaughter as an alternative, right?
Right. So basically the what wasn't offered was an instruction by the court that they could consider manslaughter. And that's one of the things that the defense in the interlocutory appeal that was taken before the Supreme Court stated as one of their grounds for double jeopardy. And that particular concept is called abandonment. And that was addressed in the decision through the Quitaug case. I'm not sure if I'm even pronouncing it correctly, but it is spelled Quitog, State versus Quitaug. Mm-hmm. And basically what that case is saying, that the prosecution abandoned the charges of murder and manslaughter. And the difference between the Quitaug case and the Deedy case, and this is what the Supreme Court says, is that in the Quitaug case, the prosecutor in that case said, all right, jury, in their closing argument, you're right, or the defense is right. There's no murder here. There's no manslaughter here. I want you to convict this person of assault, absolutely assault. But they abandoned the first two charges, which are the higher charges, murder and manslaughter, find them guilty of assault. That's not what happened in the Deedy case. In the Deedy case, the prosecution focused on the murder charge. Mm-hmm. They didn't abandon the other two charges, the lesser included. What they did was they focused on the murder charge. So what the Supreme Court's saying is that the defense in Deedy flipped the Quitaug reasoning and tried to apply it to Deedy case, and it just doesn't work in the reverse.
Well, Ronnie, this is probably a pretty good time to make the distinction between murder and manslaughter. And what would the distinction be if you offer manslaughter as a lesser option? What's the difference in the burden?
From a really more simplistic way of rather than reading out the charge itself,
right.
The simplistic way of explaining it is murder is intentional conduct. You intentionally and knowingly kill someone. Mm-hmm. In reckless manslaughter, you're behaving in a reckless manner. The state of mind changes. If you don't use due care that a normal person would, and you recklessly engage in conduct that kills someone, that's reckless manslaughter. Mm-hmm. That's the difference. It's mostly, for the most part, it's the state of mind.
Deedy now faces trial. This third Deedy trial will be on the charge of reckless manslaughter, right?
That's my understanding, because his jury actually acquitted him of the murder in the second degree in the second trial, but we have the remaining lesser included offenses.
His attorneys are going to argue he's already been. Are they going to continue arguing double jeopardy? Or, well, they, or can they not after the Supreme Court ruling?
To the jury, they cannot argue double jeopardy because this is a question of law. The Supreme Court already made that decision.
Okay.
The Hawaii Supreme Court has already made the decision. Whether they're able to take it to the feds at this point, to the federal courts, I'm not sure. I didn't see the report. Someone had reported to me that his attorneys mentioned that they were going to now take it to the federal courts. I'm not sure if they can at this interlocutory point in time. And mm-hmm. an interlocutory appeal is an appeal that's it's unusual. It's not usually taken because appeals are usually taken after a final judgment. There's no final judgment yet, right? Mm-hmm. So these are, in certain circumstances, certain cases or certain issues can be decided by the courts in between. And that's what's happening right now.
Well, now, let me just clarify. He no longer faces Sandy Jeopardy as a murder charge, right?
That's correct.
And yet he can face trial as reckless manslaughter.
That's correct.
That creates a perception of double jeopardy, doesn't it?
It does create a perception of it. I think that that's one of the things that the defense stated in their motions. I'm sorry, in their appeal. Mm-hmm. And so there are three areas that the defense focused on. One was just the double jeopardy constitutional, Hawaii State Constitution and the United States Constitution, and collateral estoppel. And I think the court, and that one, as we talked about, the court found that that was not, there was no final judgment and there was no acquittal and there was no conviction on reckless manslaughter. So they also attacked it on our statutory laws under Hawaii Revised Statute 701-109, 701-110, subsection 1, and 701.
Those numbers aren't going to mean anything.
Right, I know. I understand that, but that's what you're talking about, isn't
okay.
it? Like, isn't the same conduct? But the thing is that it may be the same conduct, but there was no actual acquittal because there was no acquittal on the conduct.
Mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court is saying reckless manslaughter can still move forward. There must be an acquittal of the lessers. Because it's different for 701-110 instead of different for 701-109. But that's exactly what you're talking about, is it seems like it is the same, but it's not.
Well,
because it's different conduct. It's a different state of mind.
From the defendant's point of view, it's changing the terminology for another bite at the apple.
Right. But it's not. It's not terminology. It's not just terminology. It's also conduct and state of mind. And state of mind is a part and an element of every criminal case.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that that the prosecutor must prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And the state of mind has to apply to every element of the charge. So it has to be, I intentionally acted this way. I intentionally knew what I was doing. I knew about the consequences of what I was doing. So it's a high standard. It's a high burden.
One of the things that emerged in the two previous trials is the defendant, Christopher Deedy, had been drinking.
Right.
He was out, you know, he was at a McDonald's. He was off work. And yet the fact that he had been drinking, admittedly, right, does not go to conduct at all?
It does go to conduct. Now, alcohol is not in and of itself, or intoxication. It shouldn't just say alcohol because it could be like drugs or anything. Anything like that, something that alters your consciousness. Intoxication, as a general rule, is not an excuse to conduct. So you can't use it as a defense. Well, I didn't know what I was doing. I was drunk. You know, mm-hmm. that just doesn't fly statutorily and in our law. That doesn't work. However, it can be something that's relevant to how they behaved or how someone behaved. Like, for example, if it's a DUI charge, of course it's going to be relevant. Mm-hmm. Drinking or intoxication is relevant to that case. If it's something that's going to help the prosecution, I would think the prosecution would want it in. If it's something that does not help the defense would try to keep it out. So there's this thing called a motion in limine, and it basically means a motion at the point or at the doorway of the trial. And that's done before the trial actually starts. And attorneys will file their motions before the court, their motions in limine, specifically spelling out, we think this is relevant, we want this to come in. We think this is not relevant, we don't want this to come in. And those kinds of things will be decided by the judge prior to trial starting.
Ronnie, I suspect we're going to learn a lot more about these kinds of things as this trial goes forward. Thanks very much for talking with us.
All right, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Ronette Kawakami is the Associate Dean of Student Services at UH Manoa's Richardson Law School. She's the former co-director of the Hawaii Innocence Project, and she served as a deputy public defender for 26 years. This is The Conversation on statewide member-support at Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the Friends of the Natatorian hope for resolution after years and years. But first, your quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about the only woman ever to serve as mayor of Honolulu. She was born in 1928 in Bell, California, and graduated from the University of Hawaii at Manoa in 1950 with a bachelor's degree in psychology. She married a retired Honolulu Police Department major and raised three children, turning to public service after working for what was then known as the Hawaiian Telephone Company, the predecessor of the present-day Hawaiian Telcom. She became the state's first budget and finance director under Governor George Ariyoshi, leaving that post to run for mayor against Frank Fassi in a Democratic primary. She won that race by a wide margin, and in 1981, as mayor, she rejected a commuter rail plan for Honolulu that her predecessor had championed, returning a $5 million federal grant that had been allocated for an engineering study and saying, "Why spend $5 million on a system that won't be built?" This morning, we're looking for her name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Ellie Carvalho from the University of Hawaii at Manoa School of Communications. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell's announcement last week that the city was determined to resolve the long-standing stalemate over the Waikiki Natatorium War Memorial did as much to reignite old differences as it did to offer new solutions. Last week we spoke with Kaimana Beach Coalition Attorney Jim Bickerton, whose group is opposed to full-scale restoration because of its cost.
The solution has to be one that isn't going to invite corporate sponsorship, so it can't be expensive. If you build some big facility, it's going to cost a lot of money to run it, to build it. And they always want something in exchange. They want to be able to hold, you know, we could have the Monsanto Natatorium and have events there and volleyball tournaments and shows, and then the commercial companies eye those bleachers. And
as with a stadium, for example.
Exactly.
The Friends of the Natatorium, whose focus is on the facility's role as a memorial to veterans of the First World War, advocates preservation, repair, and reopening of the Natatorium. Mo Radke is its president, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Mo.
Morning, Chris.
Where do you and the Friends of and Kaimana Beach Coalition differ? It would seem that in some ways you want the same thing.
It's funny that people come across a difference in more ways than not that we're actually thinking about doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Public access. We're all about public access. We never thought that the Natatorium should be anything, as he described, the Monsanto, and I think he was referring to public-private ventures.
Yeah.
when he thought about that. We're actually very similar in a variety of different things. Having the mayor come forward and expose a less expensive preservation-friendly option is a huge step in the right direction, we think.
So there is something new to be gleaned from the mayor's announcement.
Absolutely.
A new preservation-friendly option? Describe that, would you, Bill?
The new preservation option talks specifically about some decking. A perimeter deck is what he referred to it as, and it allows people to still walk around the pool of the natatorium. And the difference is the water is allowed to flow in and out of the natatorium freely and not be contained by any type of mechanical pumping or piping.
And that's been a big sticking point in the past, hasn't it?
Yes.
The flow of water in and out, because there's a health concern if the water doesn't flow, as
correct.
I understand it.
Correct. The natatorium always had a problem with circulation.
Yeah. So that problem being addressed, what other issues remain?
Well, the cost. And one of the things that the mayor had there was a previous preservation option, and it was around $69 million, and that was the enclosed pool with a mechanical pumping system. Nobody ever wanted that. The Friends didn't want that, and I'm sure the city didn't want to spend $70 million to build that. We decided, and we were always hoping for some other sort of option, maybe a hybrid, something in between, and the city has come up with that. It's not a Friends of the Natatorium design. It came from the city and county of Honolulu, and that design is exactly what we were hoping to have, something that had the water flow freely, allowed people to still use the pool in a safe and recreational manner.
How is it different? I mean, up to now we've heard basically that to get it operating the way it did when it was created would be that very high-cost option.
Right. The first option was a pool, and that was completely enclosed. Because of the cost and because of the Department Health pool rules that were generated for a saltwater pool, it became cost inefficient and not feasible. The other option of doing nothing, the mayor had indicated last week, was completely unacceptable.
That's ruled out.
It dishonors veterans. It dishonors us as the keepers of places.
Well, that's also, it would not be a no-cost option. Total destruction would not be cost-free, would it?
No. Total destruction, aside from having a lot of concrete and landfills, is going to cost a lot of money as well, including, and I'm not sure that this is being considered, it will be in the EIS, is that the water safety office is in the natatorium, and they would have to build another structure, another facility for them to be able to do what they do.
Well, we've ruled out destruction. We've ruled out the high-cost option. Are your wishes, Friends of the Natatorium wishes, and the Kaimana Beach Coalition's hopes getting closer?
I don't know if we'll ever get closer. Mr. Bickerton even said it at his last discussion on the conversation. He confessed to being an attorney and was very careful about how he framed issues. The Friends of the Natatorium is nonprofit. We have no paid employees. He's an attorney, and he's focused on an issue for his client. And the way he frames those issues, I'm not quite sure we'll ever be able to come together unless it's behind closed doors.
Well, I mean, why not?
Well, as an attorney fighting for not to have the natatorium preserved or reopened in a way that's consistent with the way they think, I don't think that they'll come to a preservation option that includes the bleachers or includes public access to its fullest.
Is it really that different from what you folks are looking for then, that option? The Kaimana Beach Coalition option, is that different from the Friends of the Natatorium option?
Their option is to build a beach. And their option is to build a beach that costs, as the mayor quoted, the same as this new preservation option, $20 to $30 million. And it's not just trucking in sand. To build a beach, they have to first let me start with the natatorium. The reason Kaimana Beach exists is because of the Cocoa Head Wall and the Makai Wall of the natatorium, and that southward flow of sand and silt and water actually deposits sand on Kaimana Beach, which created it. Mm-hmm. It was never there before. So to build a beach really means to build a beach. They would have to remove the natatorium, remove the structure that presently exists, and build new groins, major construction, out into the water in order to be able to save Kaimana and to preserve whatever stays inside the Memorial Beach.
Are those cost figures pretty solid, the ones you just cited, 20 to 30?
Those are cost figures from the city and county of Honolulu, and as the summer 2018 draft EIS comes out, those numbers will probably be more significant and more targeted.
It sounds as if the cost figures are dropping and the different options are getting closer to each other, that there might be common ground here.
I hope so. I would love to see the costs continue to drop. One of the things that we can look at getting in terms of sponsorship are sponsorships and in-kind donations from concrete workers and from unions and from a variety of other places, and not the Monsanto Natatorium. We've never wanted that. We would fight against that tooth and nail.
Well, I think the fighting tooth and nail hasn't entirely ended, Mo, but I appreciate you coming in and talking with us.
I appreciate the opportunity to share a manao.
Thanks a lot. Mo Radke is the president of Friends of the Natatorium, and you can listen to the opposing opinion in our interview with Jim Pinkerton last Wednesday on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Matson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Matson.com.
Each homeless sweep brings with it a rash of outstanding warrants, unpaid tickets, fines, and misdemeanor charges, with the net effect of ensuring that the homeless stay that way, facing added legal and economic burdens with each court appearance. The Community Outreach Court is an effort to break that cycle, and Chad Blair has more about it in today's Civil Beat Reality Check. Hi, Chad.
Hey, Chris. Good morning.
We talk often about criminalizing homelessness. That's one of the big criticisms of the sweeps and the things
sure.
that emerge from the sweeps. And this is an effort to move in the other direction, it would seem.
You know, it's nice to share a positive story about homelessness.
Yes,
we talk
it is.
So much. I know the number is going up and so forth,
yeah.
and crisis. And this is from Tanya Friedheim, who's been covering homeless quite a lot for us. And this is now the first anniversary of this community outreach court. And the good news is that it's helped 35 people go into community service, you know, like helping plant flower beds or sweeping and mm-hmm. other activities rather than to go to jail or to pay a fine. And you're right. Even Keith Kaneshiro, the prosecutor, who's not known for being soft on crime, says homelessness is a social issue, not a criminal matter. And so this is an encouraging way to reach out to people that, frankly, just they get too many warrants for their arrest and suddenly they just can't get above that. This is a way for them to sort of clean the slate and then start over and maybe even make progress towards getting a home, which, as you know, at the bottom of homelessness, it's affordable housing for so many people.
Yeah. But it also seemed that this is really clogging up the courts.
Yes, it is. I mean, think about it. We've had all sorts of problems trying to clear out the parks, but what's a police officer going to do when he sees a homeless person in a park that's been closed after hours? Well, he's going to mm-hmm. issue a citation. Mm-hmm. By the way, 3,700 citations just in the Honolulu downtown area this year, and that's like $25-$50. That really starts to add up. The courts don't want to be dealing with that. So this community outreach court really gets a social worker. That's what they do. They partner with IHS
yeah.
and other social services agencies to say, look, let's help you get on your feet again and figure this out together.
You know, if you multiplied, Chad, even those charges by, the average amount of court time each one takes to adjudicate, it's not just a problem for the people being charged, is it?
No, absolutely not. And it just becomes something that really is a bureaucratic nightmare. And the legislature sees some hope that maybe we can expand this. They actually, you know, now they're actually going to add more money, about $440,000, to try and expand this perhaps to the neighbor islands at some point. You know, this is not for the mentally ill. This is not for the people that just need all sorts of other services. This is really about helping someone take care of those parking tickets, those citations for sleeping in the wrong place, and to help them find housing and jobs. There's just no reason to have someone who's been fined like this go to a court and then maybe serve jail time. There's no purpose in that.
Well, it's a real struggle for homeless advocates to come up with success stories, and this would seem to be, in fact, for everyone concerned, right?
I know, and here we are at that time of year, right, the holiday season. This really is about getting people, you know, that really have been trapped in cycles of poverty, unpaid fines, and helping them get along. By the way, we should say there's a new program starting next year in which police officers, rather than issue citations, call a social worker instead and say, hey, maybe you can help this guy rather than me give him a ticket.
Might be a step in a healthy direction, Chad. It certainly sounds that way. Thanks for talking to us about it.
Thanks, Chris.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, and today we spoke with political and opinion editor Chad Blair.
On the next Fresh Air, seafood. Some fish you might not be familiar with that are not threatened and are good to eat. We talk with former chef Barton Seaver, who directs the Sustainable Seafood and Health Initiative at Harvard. Also, Jennifer Egan talks about her novel Manhattan Beach, which is on our book critic Maureen Corrigan's top 10 list. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Glenn Lee didn't get into the teaching profession to win prizes, but he and his Waialua High and Intermediate School students have been doing that anyway. And now Glenn is on a short list for the Global Teacher Prize, a $1 million award. He's one of 50 worldwide finalists. We spoke with him about the path that led him to where he is today.
It actually happened really suddenly. I worked very briefly. I worked for a little while at Hawaiian Electric Company, and I also worked for State Department of Accounting and General Services as an engineer. For that job, I did as an intern. And so I did that for almost about a year. And then I graduated from college and had decided that I was going to go back to school and get my master's in business, which I did 3 years later. So since my business classes were at night, I was currently working at my where I work part-time at the Honolulu Country Club. And when I was working a party in late July, the DOE had a Central District Administrators Party, which I worked.
Uh-huh.
And at that party near the pool area, I met our former principal of our school. And he basically was talking story with him because we're both from Waihua.
Uh-huh.
Both went to Lelewa High School. And through that conversation, I was telling him that I was going to go back to school. And then he asked me if I was interested in teaching, I guess, you know, for the time being.
Uh-huh.
This was a Friday afternoon. So I asked him, when would I start? You know, when would this be available? And he says, well, you can come in on Monday. And believe it or not, I did come in on that Monday. And on Tuesday, school started, and I started teaching. That was my first day of teaching, and my first on-the-job experience was on that Tuesday the following week.
Talk about getting thrown in the pool to learn how to swim, huh?
It was. And then later on, I found out there's never an opening for a very enticing position. So I it was pretty tough that first year because I guess they had a hard time finding someone to fill that role as a science teacher, and which I took on at the time.
What do you get out of teaching that you didn't get out of other types of work that you've done?
Well, I think because you work with students, it's very challenging. I mean, there's a lot of negative that's out there because it's challenging. The support part isn't as great, maybe isn't ideal for an average teacher. But I think if you can overcome that, the rewards are instant. You know, if students are doing well, they're happy, the parents are happy, they do great, whether it's a competition or a test or whatever it is that they're doing, the rewards are, you know, instantaneous. And so that's pretty gratifying when they do well, as opposed to maybe some other job which may take long, or it's some long-term project you're working on, and maybe the reward isn't as instant and as gratifying as when students are successful.
Your specialty, Glenn, is STEM learning, right? Science, technology, engineering, and math. And that involves taking some pretty difficult material to some pretty young kids. How do you get that? How do you get that across to them?
Well, I think what makes me different is that my approach is very different. I treat our program almost like a business. And so when the state says, well, or the DOE says, we want, you know, kids to be independent learners and be self-directed and be responsible and whatnot, I think it's very difficult under a traditional teaching setting to have kids do that, because that opportunity is not there. You know, you give them too much of a structured schedule where, you know, they only have your class period one every other day from 8 to 9:15. It's not realistic or real life. And so I think you have to set it up where it's more dynamic to allow kids that opportunity to be responsible. And so I think over the years I learned that the more you empower students, even though it's very tough and you feel like it's uncomfortable, and you know you're not used to it and you don't have experience doing it, I think the more you do it, the more you realize that kids actually can overcome and rise to the challenge despite whatever preconceived, you know, ideas you may have or what other people may have. And the biggest example for me is our school is a high intermediate school, and for a long time we ran our robotics program, which is a high school program, from grades 9 through 12. And about 10 years ago, you know, there was that idea of, why can't we get our middle school involved? Well, I just didn't think that they would be ready, you know, dealing with high-tech equipment, you know, things that's used in industry and whatnot, and the safety, you know, precautions. I just didn't feel like middle school kids would be mature enough or understand the bigger picture in what they were trying to, what we wanted them to do. Mm-hmm. But then I couldn't have been more wrong. I learned that actually by thinking of our program as a 7 through 12 program, even though it's primarily a high school program, by the time I got them their freshman year, they had, you know, already had 2 years of experience. So I think where most high schools, the first-year student who's a freshman is just observing and training and working under some other students or mentors more deeply, our students can be empowered at that ninth grade level because they've already been our program for a couple of years.
Younger kids are capable of more than anybody thought, is what it sounds like.
Yeah, that, and I think there's just so much. You know, as much as I think education wants us to be more creative and do all these things, it's really not set up for that. They're always telling us, finding ways for us not to do something, because there's just so much, you know, red tape. You really have to jump through hoops just to, you know, maybe go on a field trip. You know, there's just so much paperwork. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much liability forms and so on.
Yeah.
I think you can be responsible in doing those things, but doing it in a way that is going to allow your kids that experience. And so I think that's what I kind of, where I changed my mindset, was that it's not about what we cannot do. It's about, we want to do this. Let's see how we can overcome those challenges.
Kids seem to be responding in your world.
It's still tough. You know, we have a small school. There's a lot of competing programs, and so we fight to get kids in our program, primarily because, you know, like small school, big school. We have two neighboring schools, Milani High School and Lelehu High School, which are about four times larger than our school. And, you know, we're all pressured to, you know, put out the same programs. When you offer sports, you know, you want football in every school and you know, and so on. And so it's hard to get kids in our program. And so we have to really sell what we do. And I think our successes from previous years has really helped us get kids interested and helped us recruit as we get kids into our program.
Glenn Lee is an engineering and technology teacher from Waialua High and Intermediate School, who recently was shortlisted among 50 other teachers worldwide for the Global Teacher Prize. Over the last decade, 87% of his students have met proficiency in reading and math on the Hawaii State Assessment. 71% have maintained a 3.0 GPA or higher. You can learn more about him and his work on the Conversations Facebook page.
Aloha, I'm Eric Soberger from Hawaii International Music Festival. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at the massive universe around our tiny planet, as well as what we can look for in our dark island skies. As usual, we've got the expertise of Christopher Phillips to fill us in on those details, and we're grateful to have him on the line right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be back. For this week, Stargazers, keep an eye out for Jupiter as it continues to grace us with its presence in the dawn sky. The moon this week will be waxing from a mere crescent to its first quarter phase, making a pleasant companion to an evening stargazing.
This week, you've got more on a discovery of some planets, and it was made with Google's artificial intelligence?
Yeah, recently it was announced that Google's artificial intelligence, or AI for short, had discovered planets around the star Kepler-90. Astonishingly, multiple planets were discovered in the data, and the system is now thought to contain 8 major planetary bodies. What's interesting about this system is that it's one of the first we have seen that actually resembles our own solar system, in the fact that the small planets are close in around the star and the larger planets are farther out.
In terms of the artificial intelligence aspect of this and that being responsible for finding the planets, is that really true?
Well, the reporting has been a bit misleading. The researchers use machine learning algorithms to find these planets. That means teaching a computer program to look for certain patterns in data. There was no real thinking machine behind this discovery. So the machine learning algorithms picked out this data from observations already recorded by the Kepler Space Telescope, but they actually haven't been followed up by any other observatories yet.
Were there any actual visual, so they don't have pictures of these things, it's just like looking at the data and saying, when you look at this data, it looks like there must be objects there.
Exactly, yeah.
Also a chance that it's misreading the data and there aren't any objects there.
Well, the researchers were quite rigorous in their criteria when they gave this data to the machine learning algorithms. They tried to weed out things like false positives.
Makes sense. And so talking about this new system, is there a chance we could find an Earth-like planet there since it resembles our own solar system so much?
Well, as always, when it comes to these apparently Earth-like planets, we shouldn't get too excited. Some of the smaller planets in this system orbit very close to their stars, and others whip around their stars in orbits that would make your head spin. So basically, no twin Earth just yet.
Well, we know who's going to give us the information when it arrives, unless you get beaten to it by other news sources, and that'll be you, Christopher Phillips. And thank you so much. We appreciate it.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii. Walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki. Featuring ZipPass, a new online tool to secure a place in line. AmazingUrgentCare.com.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about the Honolulu mayor who rejected a proposed commuter rail plan for Honolulu that included a proposed 23-mile run between Aloha Stadium and Hawaii Kai. $5 million in federal funds had been allocated, but in 1981, she sent the money back, saying, "We don't need a $5 million study to make our decision." She supported expansion of the bus system instead, adding 80 to 100 new vehicles to the 400 then in operation. She had defeated Mayor Frank Fossey to win her single term in office, defeating him in the Democratic primary. When the next election cycle came around, Fossey switched parties and won his seat back. She was the only woman to ever serve as Honolulu's mayor, citing fiscal responsibility as her watchword and as her justification for canceling the rail project. It was the first iteration of HART, our Honolulu Area Rapid Transit. Today we asked you for the name of the woman who took office on January 2, 1981, and left in 1985. It's Eileen Anderson, and that's today's quiz. The winner is Joe in Hawaii Kai, who was first to call in. We got lots of calls from folks who remember Mayor Anderson, and we thank you for them. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Hawaii's public schools are unique in the nation. They belong to the only statewide school district in the entire country. The Hawaii Department of Education is responsible for overseeing and supplying dozens of school complexes spread over seven islands. Part of that charge means supplying the schools with students every day. In 2013, the DOE began an initiative called Get On Board that used tech tools like GPS and routing software to improve the efficiency of its busing program. 4 years later, the program is producing measurable savings, as Assistant Superintendent Dan Carson told Conversation producer Ryan Finnerty.
As you mentioned, we are a state district, so we're on seven islands, so obviously very spread out. I will say the way we have handled busing is through contract, just given the diversity and again, how it's dispersed throughout the entire state. So from that perspective, again, it does make our job a little bit easier, but at the same time, managing those contracts, 5 years ago, that got a little bit out of control. The ledge got involved and put some restraints on us and said, get it under control. And that's when we started our Get On Board program. We've been at this for about 4 years now. Over those 4 years, starting with a pilot in Oahu and then the island of Oahu the next year, followed by most recently, this last year, obviously, the Kauai and the Maui. And it was a combination of, again, adjusting the way we were going about contracting, making sure that we created a competitive environment so that, again, we could drive some of those prices down. But in the process of that, too, we've been able to improve a lot in our transportation. So we have cameras on all of our buses. We got GPS on all the buses. I can tell you at any one time when the bus was at a certain bus stop, again, it's all tracked. We have all that data that we never had before. We've saved the state $13 million annually, and that's a recurring annual cost, which, again, is pretty phenomenal. We went from about a little over $72 million budget down to a little less than $60 million budget.
So, Dan, give me an overview of the project. What problems or challenges with busing were you trying to solve, and what methods did you use?
Well, one, we used this as an opportunity to actually, again, get us up to, again, I would say industry standards. So where we have cameras on the buses and we can track them and we have the data. We've got a group of route planners that are trying to find the most efficient ways to run routes. We're able to utilize that, but at the same time, create a competitive environment so that we were forcing that competition. We've now got a team of about seven different contractors that have kind of spread out the work across the state. In the end, competition breeds efficiency, and we were able to do that and at the same time upgrade our buses.
So you use contracts, the DOE uses contracts to do busing. How does it work when you have to actually physically upgrade a bus that's owned by a third party like one of these contractors?
That's a good question. Again, it obviously has to be done contractually, but Oahu is probably a really good example because we rolled out the program, but really didn't have the inclusion of video cameras on our buses at that time. But we followed up in later years because we wanted that capability on our buses from just a safety security standpoint. So we wrote that into the contract, and obviously that came at a little bit of a cost, but at the same time, it is done through a contract, and we're able to, again, institute those video cameras on the Oahu buses. At this point now, all of our buses across the state have video camera capability, and that was all, again, done through the contract. So while it's not as easy as just us going out and doing it through a contract, we can obviously easily execute that and probably saving us a lot more money than if we actually had that internally.
How does GPS and mapping software help you improve service provided to students actually waiting for a bus every day?
Well, it gives us obviously historical data. So when a parent comes to us and says, "Hey, Johnny, the bus didn't show up until so and so," and again they're claiming that it's late, we can actually pull up those records and determine what the issue was, if it was late, if it wasn't late, and then obviously troubleshoot from there to try and make it right and make sure that we're giving the right times, we're giving the appropriate information. But it also drives efficiencies because we've got a team of people now that, again, monitor those things. We call them route planners. They literally try and find efficiencies by monitoring those and knowing exactly where the buses are and, again, looking at the historical data, as well as, again, as the school year starts, just trying to develop the routes. And, again, there was a topic that was at the beginning of this year. The term was used consolidation, but, I mean, if you have two routes right next to each other and they're both running at 30% capacity, then why not, again, shut down one of those routes? Because we pay for a bus per day fee is the way the contracts are written up. So anytime we can reduce the bus load, if you will, then obviously we can reduce the overall cost of that contract. So that's a way in which, by monitoring that, having the GPSs on those buses and having that historical data, that we can actually drive efficiency.
Dan, in the old days before this program was implemented, how was a school bus route planned?
It was manual. It was papers everywhere. It was just a very laborious type of process that involved a lot of paperwork and a lot of guesswork, in particular, as you started a school year, again, just trying to get that information out, for example, and, again, trying to estimate where kids are going to be. Now when they register for school, again, that's tied to our software as well, so that we know exactly where they're located. We can tell them exactly where their bus stop is and exactly what time the bus is going to show up.
Dan, you mentioned that this program has so far saved on average $13 million per year. It's been running for 4 years now. Does the DOE have any plan to reinvest that money? Would it go into transportation or elsewhere in the department's budget?
Well, the good thing is, by saving that comes out of our general operating fund. So, again, our educators can use that to improve education systems. It's just part of the whole pool that we have in that general operating budget. And by saving $13 million in this bucket, it frees it up for use in other areas. Obviously, we have a lot of needs and a lot of things that we're trying to fund, and this only helps that problem, the fact that we've actually freeing up $13 million. Whether or not it goes directly back into transportation, obviously, I would like to see some of that, but it actually goes into the bigger pool of the entire Department of Education and obviously benefits the entire state.
And Dan, earlier in the year, we saw an issue of a shortage of school bus drivers, particularly on Maui, not specifically related to this program, but has that issue been adequately resolved? And is there anything, any aspect of this program that can help mitigate some of those types of issues in the future?
It definitely has been resolved. Again, bus service on Maui is back up to normal and Kauai is back up to normal. We can still use CDLs, though. And the issue really, I think, is more there's a CDL shortage across the entire nation. And there's other very large districts like ours that we were a few buses short. I mean, there are some districts that were hundreds of buses short when they started the school year this year. So we did, again, part of that bus shortage was had to do with the renewal of the contracts on Maui and Kauai and just kind of the equalizing of that. I mean, overall, it came down to the CDL issue, and CDL is just commercial driver's license. So, again, a lack of those people. We face a recurring issue in the fact that our contractors will actually take a new person in and get them their commercial driver's license and start employing them. But then you take the city bus system here on Oahu, and they're in constant demand of bus drivers. So we end up losing a lot of our bus drivers to companies like that, who, again, can pay them for 8 hours a day as opposed to just the 4 hours a day that they're making as a bus driver. So, again, that's an issue that we're aware of, and we're dealing with it. I'm proud of our contractors for, again, providing that service and actually providing an increase in the commercial driver license type qualified people in the state.
All right, Dan Carlson, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Ryan. Appreciate it.
Dan Carlson is the Assistant Superintendent for the Office of School Facilities and Support Services. The Get On Board program began in 2013 and has incorporated GPS buses and automated route planning software into the department's transportation plan. There are a lot of different activities going on around the state at any given day, and Morning Edition host Derek Malama joins us at this point in our show to look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Today we're going to walk across New Guinea.
Yes.
Talk about under the radar.
Boy, right? This is happening in Kona on Tuesday. You can learn about a woman who traveled solo across Papua New Guinea. The travel group at Kona Stories Bookstore is discussing the book Four Corners by Kira Salek. And she was 24 when she made the trip alone by canoe and on foot. And Salek explores also the demons in her past that drove her to take this journey. The travel group meets at 6:30 at Kona Stories Bookstore. Bring a pupu or beverage to share.
And Keiki will get creative tomorrow in Wailuku.
Yes, kids in grades 3 and up will upcycle old books and magazines to create Christmas trees and craft handmade cards to give away for the holidays. All materials will be provided. This is happening at 2:30 in the Wailuku Public Library.
Upcycle.
Yeah, I know. That's a new word to me.
new one on me, but that's what we're here for,
yeah,
right, Derek?
Right, yes.
We enjoy some music for the holidays Tuesday in Mililani.
Yes, and this is coming from soldiers from the 25th Infantry Division Big Band. They're called Tropic Knights, and they'll perform holiday jazz and swing classics. The concert is at the center stage at Mililani Shopping Center from 6 to 7 tomorrow, and it's free.
Expect some impressive musicianship,
sure,
as always.
Definitely.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, we'll look at the impact of recent sexual harassment scandals with a panel of legal experts, and we'll be taking your calls. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. If you missed any of the show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow.